I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio. Well, you might not know it or recognize it, but here in the East anyway, we are at war, and it's a kind of warfare that we likely experience every day. Here with me in Studio 3 to explain is Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turned backyards into battlegrounds. Jim Sterba is here. Welcome, Jim. Good to have you back.
Nice to be here.
So you have this premise that basically the wildlife comeback miracle turned into a total mess. How so?
Well, the forests came back, recreating the habitat. The conservation movement slowly brought all these wild creatures that had been killed off by market hunters in the last century back.
Wolves, everything.
Everything.
Deer, everything.
Yeah. And then people sprawled out into the countryside after the Second World War, kept going further and further out, so that by the year 2000, an absolute majority of the American people lived not in cities, not in farms, but in this middle muddle, filling up with wildlife. And some of them were just nuisance. Some of them are intimidating. Some of them are obviously overabundant. And we haven't figured out how to deal with them. We argue with one another all the time about what to do about beavers.
I know. You know, I was going to ask you about beavers because it's so interesting you say that because one of your opening chapters about where you live sounds like a place I go to in the summer. And we didn't used to have beavers in a lake, and now we have beavers.
Well, beavers were the first animal to go when explorers arrived and started trading with the Indians. In fact, they paid for their passage by sending beaver pelts back. And so the beavers were all trapped out before settlers arrived, and certainly in Massachusetts. And they kept being trapped out around the country. And by the end of the 19th century, there were 5 beavers left in one family in the Adirondacks.
Yeah.
And the conservation movement brought some from Canada, restocked them.
Why do we want them?
There are no predator. Well, they're a wonderful wetlands manager. They create beautiful habitat for all sorts of other species. They, with their dams, they control flooding, and
or create it.
And they back it up, but they also create these very verdant meadows because the water settles behind the dams, the nutrients settle, and they're just wonderful eco-engineers.
Hmm. And some of the others white-tailed deer, why are there so many? I know that they were hunted, and certainly back, hundreds of years ago, it was much more prevalent that you use their skins, you use their meat, but They're everywhere.
No, predators. We create in the sprawl wonderful habitat for white-tailed deer. We give them food, water, edges, places to hide.
We grow flowers so they can eat them.
All sorts of wonderful food. And there are no deer predators. And in fact, man is one of the big, if not the biggest deer predator out there. And we've taken ourselves out of the predation business across huge swaths of sprawl. In Massachusetts, for example, there are 2 laws. One that says you can't discharge a firearm within 150 feet of a hard surface road. The second says within 500 feet of an occupied dwelling without the occupant's permission. Those 2 laws alone put almost 60% of the entire state of Massachusetts off limits to hunting with guns.
What about a bow and arrow?
Well, there are 351 municipalities in the state, and almost half of them have laws that are even further restrict hunting, and some of them even restrict bow and arrow hunting because a lot of people are anti-hunting.
I know, but isn't hunting also restricted to certain times of the year?
Yeah, but in places where they have had overabundant deer populations, you can adjust those seasons.
Yeah.
In places, I think in South Carolina, the season runs something like 3 months, and a hunter can kill 1 deer a day for that. But why would he?
Yeah.
Once his freezer's full, and he can give a deer away, but you can't sell these animals. It's against the law.
Well, don't a lot of them do it just for the fun of it? Do they actually take it and...
No, maybe there are hunters who like to kill things, but most of the hunters that I know want to go and stalk or kill a deer and eat the venison, and they don't want to gratuitously kill. I mean, those are beautiful animals.
I always get suspicious. There's a story just today about a hunter found dead in the woods and obviously shot by another hunter. But why didn't he go, if he thought it was a deer, why didn't he go get it?
Well, it's really interesting because there are some suburbs that are beginning to realize that hunters can do them a favor. And when you realize mm-hmm. that hunters kill about 100 people a year, mostly each other, mistaken identity, deer now kill more than twice that number.
People?
When they,
4,000 a day? That sounds like an exaggerated.
No. My State Farm says something like 3,300 a day, 1.2 million a year.
Really?
My figures come from Utah State University, and they're up now to 1.5 to 2 million deer car crashes a year. And because many of them aren't reported or the deer goes off nobody knows why the person veered into the tree or something.
Yeah, we see a lot of them up in upstate New York. So I can remember when I was a kid, in the fall, when the Canada geese would fly over, it was a novelty. It was a wonderful thing. You could hear them honking, and wow, there goes a Canada goose. It's like now, I mean, they're the proverbial rats with wings.
When Canada geese were so low in the 50s and 60s, even that you saw one, and it made the local newspaper.
Yeah, exactly.
Same way with deer in many areas. But what happened with the Canada geese is a really interesting story. Market hunters, commercial hunters, guys that sold to butcher shops and restaurants and so on, used live decoy flocks of Canada geese to lure in migrating flocks. And in 1935, those live decoy flocks were outlawed finally. The migrating geese were decimated. And so the state fish and wildlife people and the federal fish and game wildlife service restocked new refuges with these decoy flocks of geese, hoping they'd take up the migration. But they didn't, because they hadn't migrated for many generations.
Yeah.
They didn't migrate because they were locally mm-hmm. raised. And geese migrate to where they were born and learned mm-hmm. how to fly. Well, these geese were born here. They were already home, so they didn't migrate. And all those geese have taken up residence on our golf courses and soccer fields.
It's unreal. I mean, the city of Boston, excuse me, says they have more than a population of something like 40,000. I mean, it's just unbelievable.
Well, I mean, there are people who like to have geese around.
Name one. Who wants to have geese around?
Well,
they ruin the esplanade, the grass. It's just awful.
What happens is that a lot of people want to save geese or deer or all that sort of stuff until you reach a point where the nuisance value or damage that they do outweighs the having lovely animals around. People call it the social carrying capacity. And you reach a tipping point after which people want to kill all the deer or all the geese or most of them. And in the case of Flight 1549, U.S. Airways, people think about geese every time they board an airplane.
Yeah, there was just another one. It was actually a loon. Plane hit a loon and turned around. Everybody was okay. But we're going to take your calls today at 877-301-8970. 877-301-8970. I'm talking to Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars. We'd like to hear some of your war stories with nature. Maybe you've done something to control it. Maybe you've done something to lure them in, like having bears in your backyard because that's where your compost heap is or something like that. You also, though, Jim, claim that people have become disconnected from nature. What do you mean by that?
Well, over many generations, we moved off the farms. Less than 1% of the population actually lives on a farm these days. And when you're out there on the landscape and you're outdoors, you're much more closely connected with the knowledge of stewardship of the landscape and even some of the destructive things that my grandparents did to the weasel in the hen house and so on. But what's happened is that we've become indoor people. We get our nature from movies and TV and increasingly from digital screens where images can be chopped up and edited and themes can be put in these stories to anthropomorphize these creatures, to make them seem like children, to make them seem just like people. They act like people. And when when you don't have bears around, pretty soon the bear turns up in your backyard and you think, oh, it's a bear just like the bear in the movie. That's a little let's get a donut. Let's throw it a cookie. Mm. Take its picture. Our bear, start an album. And pretty soon you've trained that bear to associate the smell of people with food, not fear. The bear's going to come back. And eventually the bear's going to do this enough so that the bear's going to be put down. The bear's going to be killed. And it's not the bear's fault. It's the people's fault because they don't understand that these are wild creatures.
Talking to Jim Sterba, give us a call, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, Close Encounters of the Nature Kind. Talking about nature wars and how our efforts to bring wildlife back has actually created a whole mess. We've been overrun by beavers, white-tailed deer, Canada geese, wild turkeys, coyotes. Coyotes is another incredible phenomenon. You see them in the city. You see them in Boston, downtown, we've seen them.
Yesterday, a Chicago Sun-Times photographer photographed two of them outside Wrigley Field, just standing there near the turnstiles. And I have a guy that I quote in the book who studies downtown Chicago coyotes. He says there are 2,000 of them in the city.
Wow.
They adjust really.
Yeah, sure.
They're really,
plenty to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of rats and mice. And
lots of cats. Lots of small dogs, too.
We had a Fisher cat in the garage over here.
Mm.
That is an amazing creature.
It is.
And quite frightening.
And it chases cats up trees.
Yes, and then it climbs up after them. All right, we're taking your calls today, 877-301-8970. We've got Anne from Dorchester. Anne, what's your close encounters of the nature kind?
My close encounter is with turkeys.
Mm-hmm.
I lived in Holbrook a few years back and literally had to rescue a grandmother and two little toddlers who lived across the street from me who were in a tiny mini car, and four turkeys were surrounding the car. And they were like, what, grandmother was looking at me and going, help, you know, so I had a rake in my hand and went over, you know, like, say, go away, you guys, you know, get away from this car. Wow. And they all went, woo, ran away into the neighbor's yard. And, you know, and it's happened before. I've heard from other neighbors.
Yes, they're aggressive.
That they chase cars down the street.
But can they hurt?
I love them because they're really smart, and I'm a bird lover, but it's like, wow, they're aggressive.
Jim, are they dangerous at all? Can they?
I don't see why. I mean, they fly into
thanks for the call, Ann.
They'll fly into your windshield. You know, if you throw a rock at them, they'll probably run away, just like coyotes. But they're an example of species that were once thought to be very, very people shy, and they've adjusted to life in the suburbs better than. And then, you know, there are stories of them chasing mailmen around and so on, and kids, and they're a big bird. I mean,
are they edible? The wild turkeys?
Oh, sure, yeah. They're wonderful. They're like deer. They're free-range, antibiotic-free, locavore protein.
Mm, yeah, I'm surprised more people don't take them and, you know, cook them.
They're hard to hunt. Turkeys are one of the most interesting species that hunters like to hunt because they're so wily. But boy, they've certainly taken up life in the sprawl.
Yeah, You see them a lot by the side of the road. All right, we've got Clark from Beverly. What's your story, Clark?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yep. Go ahead.
I'm in Beverly, Mass. right now, but I actually live in New Hampshire, and just a quick story and a question. The story was a couple years ago, I'm driving my Tahoe, and I hit a deer, which wasn't too pleasant, but long and the short of it, it wasn't my truck, so I had to go tell the person whose truck it was that it was wrecked, and about 15 minutes later, we got back to the deer. And there was already three other groups of people fighting over the meat.
Really?
Obviously, I got to keep it because I had, you know, the deer all over the front of my car. I was curious that there was that much interest in the
really?
Meat. I've never had it, but they're everywhere. It wouldn't seem to me like there'd be so much interest.
Huh. What's your question?
Why is there so much interest? There's deers everywhere. How in 5 minutes did three groups of people start fighting over a dead deer in the road?
I don't know. We'll let Jim Sterba answer. Thanks for that, Clark.
Some local law enforcement people keep lists, and when And when somebody hits a deer and reports it, they call the next person on the list and say, if you want to, go
really?
Out and collect that deer. Most times the deer or large parts of a deer are so bloodied by hitting a vehicle that there isn't much meat that's good. But I know backstrap are usually pretty – they're very good to eat. And a lot of people pick up roadkill deer and feed their dogs and so
that
on.
I could understand, maybe feeding your dog. But, I mean, most roadkill that I've seen seems to still be there. I wouldn't know if they picked it up. But
if you get it quickly enough and get it dressed out and skinned enough quickly.
The worst thing is when they don't die. I actually have a really gruesome story because we were all going out one night last summer and the car in front of us hit a deer and clipped off its the rear end, essentially. The deer was stunned. It was in shock. It just stood there. But it was alive, and it was awful. And I don't know what happened, whether somebody came and put it down or what.
And yet we take this roadkill problem and we've turned it into a joke because we don't think we can do anything about it. I mean, we can be more careful. We can watch when we're driving, sunset and sunup. But, you know, we crumple all these animals and essentially there's nothing we can do. We think it's a price of transportation.
Yeah, I guess. Why is it only the does, by the way? How come the bucks? It's always a doe, never a buck.
Well, many months of the year, bucks don't have antlers, remember? Mm-hmm. So you may be hitting a buck that you don't know is a buck.
Mm-hmm. It seems like it's the does that wander into the but I could.
Yeah, what do they know? What do the bucks know that the does
exactly.
don't
That's
know?
That's what I'm trying to get at.
Or is that the new answer to the old joke, why did the chicken cross the road to show the deer how it's done?
We're taking your calls today, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. We're talking to Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars, the incredible story of how wildlife comebacks turn backyards into a battleground. And we've got Dan from New Hampshire. Go ahead, Dan.
Hi. I have a question. The guest, I forget his name on your show.
Yeah.
Jim suggested that part of the problem is with the top predator in the environment being absent. The wolf creates problems with deer populations and other game animals. Is there ever any possibility that wolves would be reintroduced either naturally or intentionally by game officials in this area?
In this area? That's a good question because it has definitely happened in other areas. Thanks for that, Dan.
The problem is sprawl. Do people really want the top deer predators, cougars and wolves, wandering around in suburban, exurban sprawl areas where deer are multiplying the fastest? The only real legitimate deer predator in these areas is people. And you can either have hunters do it, or what many towns do now with a deer problem is to hire sharpshooters. And you're using tax dollars to do that, whereas hunters buy a license from the state to do what you want done. I think that cougars and wolves are slowly moving in this direction, I don't see the Massachusetts Fish and Wildlife Service introducing them to a state as densely populated as this one is.
You know, when I was going through your book, there were other aspects of this. It's not just about the critters, too. You were had this story you were telling about how you wanted to clear these what looked like invasive grapevines that were choking birch trees and other flora and fauna right near a beautiful waterfall, and it was just blocked out the view, took all the sunlight, and you took it upon yourself to start cutting these vines down. Tell that story.
I saw these feral grapes, as I call them, an invasive species up on Mount Desert Island right in Acadia National Park. And I saw them strangling these trees, and so I decided to liberate the native trees.
Yeah.
And it wasn't until much, much later that I discovered what had really happened was that that island by 1880 was half deforested. Every bit of land that could be used to grow hay and crops for the livestock was and so there were all these farms on and what happened slowly was that people stopped farming and the trees took all this land back. The same thing happened in the eastern third of the United States. I mean, millions of acres were abandoned by farmers and trees slowly took them back. So what looks like a forest in the national park in Acadia is really a regrown forest
on
old farmland.
So the grapes were a natural.
So the grapes were first.
They were first before the
right.
before the trees.
Right.
Yeah. Well, as you said, had you known, you could have been fined like $500,000 or something if they had been caught you. All right, taking your calls today, 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Subject is nature wars. We've got John from Providence. Go ahead, John.
How are you?
Good.
I live in Providence. I play golf on a course about 5 minutes outside of Providence. I have seen foxes, coyotes, fisher cats, all types of animals. My question for you is, one, what kind of animals can we expect to see in the coming years that we don't currently see?
Hmm.
And two is, should my 14-year-old be concerned when she's out golfing by herself when she sees coyotes and fox and fisher cats?
All right. Thanks for that, John.
If she carries a couple of rocks in her pocket and throws them at the coyote's going to run away. Fishers are, I don't think, much of a threat to people, and foxes certainly aren't. I'd be more leery of her slipping on goose doo-doo on the fairway and breaking a leg or something than I would these creatures. As far as which other creatures are moving in, and all of these animals that whose populations are growing spread as they grow, and they move in to new territories that are unoccupied by others. And so there are, of course, lots of species that are going in the other direction. But I think you're going to see more. You're going to certainly see more moose around here, and you're going to see populations of bears are growing. Coyotes have moved in from the high plains over the last 30 or 40
years. But did you say cougars too, because they're coming from the west?
Well, there was that one incident in Connecticut last year where one cougar came all the way from the South Dakota Black Hills over 1,500 miles and got hit by a car.
Yeah, that was an amazing story.
Cougars need a lot of space. And so as their populations grow in the west, which is where they are, there are about 100,000 there, they're gradually moving east. Wolves are gradually moving south from Canada and the Great Lakes area.
Aren't there some good news stories, too? I mean, there's been an incredible explosion of the population of some birds of prey, eagles, hawks, blue heron. They're everywhere now.
That's true, and this is just wonderful news. I mean, this is an incredible success story that happens in very few other places in the world, that we managed to stop the destruction. These early conservationists in the last part of the 19th century put an end to this relentless killing of anything with a value for feathers and fur and meat and so on, and gradually put into place a system which is called the North American model. You give the wildlife to everybody. You say it belongs to everybody, not just a commercial hunter. The state regulates it for you, and it allows you an opportunity to enjoy it, to hunt it, to do whatever, to photograph it, to do whatever you want, if you obey the rules. And that's what's brought all of these populations back, and the habitat that allows all sorts of birds and so on. Unfortunately, some animals are ruining the habitat for others. Deer eating out the understory of forests threaten the forest birds that live there. Mm. And that's a problem of too many deer in the forest.
All right, taking your calls today about nature wars, 877-301-8970. We've got Jeff from Warwick, Rhode Island. Go ahead, Jeff.
Yeah, we had a bear down here in Cranston. Now, I talked to a biologist recently who thinks there may be even 4 or 5 bears in the area, possibly, because there's quite a greenway along the Patuxent River, and there's quite a few power lines with quite a strip of woods. Is that possible?
Absolutely. I mean, bears adjust to sprawl areas just as well as lots of other species, especially if there's enough food around, and there's plenty of food in the sprawl. I mean, New Jersey now has bears in every county.
Yeah. And we had that bear, remember, Jeff, that walked from Worcester all the way out to the tip of Cape Cod last summer. Same bear. They tranquilized it, brought it back into the Worcester area in the woods. He got up and walked back to Cape Cod. It was an incredible story.
And this one was in a commercial area, walking right in front of commercial buildings. And they caught him on video just because they had cameras.
Wow.
Dumpsters in back of commercial areas are great food sources for bears.
Okay. Thanks for that, Jeff.
Take care.
Yeah. So what's going to happen, Jim? Are we just going to be overrun by critters and start over again?
We're going to, as a keystone species ourselves, we have the ability to manage the ecosystems in which we live for the good of all of their inhabitants, plants, animals, and people. And once we figure out how to do this, we can solve our problems. But we haven't figured out whether we want to do this yet. A lot of people say leave nature alone, even though we're out in it up to our keisters, as Ronald Reagan might have said. We're all over. And so we're managing right now, whether we know it or not. We just have to do it better.
Okay. Jim Sterba, author of Nature Wars. And I should mention, Jim, you're going to be on my television show tonight, Greater Boston, at 7. So we would like anybody listening who's got pictures of your encounters with furry friends or wild birds of any sort, if you've got a good shot or some sort of short video of a coyote or a bear or anything, send us a picture. At Boston Public Radio at WGBH.org, Boston Public Radio at WGBH.org. And I think Jim's going to be at the Athenaeum tonight if anybody wants to meet him in person. That's at 6 o'clock. So Boston Public Radio at WGBH.org. Send us those pictures. Thanks a lot, Jim. See you later.
Thank you.
All right, now that President Obama has won a second term, what does he owe his constituents, particularly Latino voters who supported the president by 75%? Callie Crossley has that conversation. I'm Emily Rooney. This is Boston Public Radio.